From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I'm told this is a production platform about 100 miles off the coast. I'm told the depth of water is about 340 feet.
Another oil and gas rig has exploded in the Gulf of Mexico. Some reports say an oil sheen is visible near the site. We'll get the latest. Then it's back to school. As millions of children around the country begin a new school year, the Obama administration is aggressively moving forward on a number of education initiatives. We'll talk to the head of the Chicago Teachers Union and a professor of education. And a new study finds CEOs who fired the most workers during the recession took home the highest pay. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Another oil and gas rig has exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, about 100 miles south of the Louisiana coast. The fire broke out on a platform operated by Mariner Energy Thursday morning. 13 workers were rescued more than 2 hours after jumping into the Gulf to avoid the fire. Coast Guard and company officials said there is no evidence of leaks, but there were reports that an oil sheen could be seen near the site. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal said toxic dispersants could be used if an underwater spill develops.
They report they've got pre-approval to do that, but again, they're not planning to use dispersants this time based on only the sheen being visible. The company suspects that what is burning now is what was actually in storage. They had about 100 barrels of condensate on the platform in storage. Again, we don't have independent confirmation of what is burning at this time. This would also be a very important point.
In other oil drilling news, the New York Times is reporting BP has warned Congress that if lawmakers pass legislation barring the company from new offshore drilling permits, it may not have the funds to pay for all the damages caused by its Gulf of Mexico oil spill. The latest developments come as environmental activists are ratcheting up calls for a ban on offshore drilling. Earlier this week, over 200 people took part in protests against BP and Chevron in San Francisco. 15 people were arrested after taking part in a blockade outside BP's offices. The Reverend Kenneth Davis of the Bay Area Coalition of Concerned Citizens spoke out as the protests stopped in front of the Chevron building.
Not a nice thing when we think about the poorest people in the world have to suffer the injustices of those that inhabit places like this. We want you to all understand that these robbers, crooks, and killers, they also come in three-piece suits and ties. Here is environmental injustice. Environmental injustice when they can pour the pollution in my neighborhood, make me breathe it, and tell me that I should love it.
We'll have more oil drilling coverage after headlines. The U.S.-led NATO force is being accused of killing 10 civilians in an airstrike in Afghanistan's northern Takhar province. Appearing with the visiting defense secretary, Robert Gates, Afghan President Hamid Karzai said the victims were campaign workers for a candidate in Afghanistan's upcoming parliamentary elections.
The reports that we get so far, 10 are killed and 3 wounded in this operation. Nature of the operation and the presence of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan's personalities or activists have to be determined. But we do know that the parliamentarian, the candidate, is wounded and 10 are killed. We are investigating it. And as it turns out, we will then share the information with our allies, the United States and NATO.
The Afghan government, meanwhile, is facing the potential collapse of its largest bank. Scores of account holders have pulled their money from the Kabul Bank this week amid speculation the bank is headed for insolvency. Kabul Bank has faced allegations of making illegal loans to well-connected insiders and shareholders. In an interview with The Washington Post, Hamid Karzai's brother, Mahmoud Karzai, called for a U.S. intervention to shore up the bank's finances. Mahmoud Karzai is one of the bank's top shareholders. In other news from Afghanistan, the military says a chaplain killed in a bombing this week is the first Army clergy person killed in combat since the Vietnam War. Captain Dale Getz of Fort Carlson was among 5 soldiers who died in a roadside bombing. Israeli and Palestinian leaders have agreed to further talks following this week's U.S. brokered summit in Washington. The two sides will meet again on September 14th and then every 2 weeks thereafter. U.S. Middle East envoy George Mitchell said the Obama administration hopes to see an agreement within a year.
Our goal is to resolve all of the all of the core issues within 1 year. And the parties themselves have suggested and agreed that the logical way to proceed to tackle them is to try to reach a framework agreement first. We will put our full weight behind these negotiations and will stand by the parties as they make the difficult decisions necessary to secure a better future for their citizens.
The talks are being held despite Israel's refusal to freeze settlement construction in the occupied West Bank. On Thursday, the head of the West Bank Settlers Council, Naftali Bennett, declared an end to Israel's partial settlement freeze and vowed massive building.
Immoral freeze on a Jewish building in the land of Israel is over. And as of now, in dozens of locations across Judea and Samaria, the mountain range of Judea and Samaria, we're building.
Bennett's group, the Yesha Council, says construction is taking place in at least 80 settlements across the West Bank. Palestinian Authority spokesperson Ghassan Hatib said although Israel has never fully stopped expanding settlements, Palestinians now expect a frenzy of settlement construction.
Unfortunately, Israel has never stopped the settlement expansion, including in the so-called moratorium that they announced. But yesterday in particular, there was a massive resumption of settlement expansion and activities in many places in the Palestinian territories. There was a very dangerous decision by the municipality of occupied Jerusalem to resume construction of homes in certain parts of occupied East Jerusalem. There was also laying ground and laying foundations for new construction in three settlements in the West Bank.
A new survey shows U.S. companies are increasingly pushing health care costs onto their employees. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, 30% of over 3,000 companies say they've reduced health benefits or increased workers' share of the cost this year. 23% said they'd raised employee premiums. Employees with family health care plans are now paying an average 14% more per year. A Hawaiian grand jury has indicted four people on charges of forcing around 400 Thai nationals to work as farm laborers after luring them to the United States. The defendants are employees of the Los Angeles-based labor contractor Global Horizons Manpower. The workers were allegedly promised lucrative jobs, only to have their passports seized. They were then forced to pay thousands of dollars in so-called recruitment fees that put them in debt to the defendants. A Los Angeles garment company, meanwhile, has reached a settlement over allegations it subjected workers to sweatshop-like conditions. Around 50 minimum wage workers accused 17 Incorporated of forcing them to work 12-hour shifts, sometimes back-to-back, without breaks or overtime for 6 days a week. The workers also say they were exposed to harmful chemicals, a cockroach and rodent infestation, and with no way of leaving the factory in case of a nighttime emergency. The factory has supplied clothes to well-known retailers, including Forever 21 and Macy's. Under the settlement, workers will receive compensation for unpaid overtime and, in what prosecutors call an unprecedented provision for a U.S.-based factory in a labor case, an independent monitor will observe the factory for a year. And an environmentalist with a long rap sheet for various radical actions has been sentenced to another 4 months in prison for having a minimal online interaction with another activist. A U.S. district judge in Michigan ruled that Rod Coronado had violated the terms of his parole after he accepted a Facebook friend request from fellow radical activist Mike Rizzell. In accepting Rizzell's friend request, Coronado's action amounted to one click of his computer's mouse. Coronado was also using what his parole officer called an unauthorized computer. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Another oil and gas rig exploded yesterday in the Gulf of Mexico, renewing calls for the government to impose a ban on offshore oil drilling. The fire broke out on a rig operated by Mariner Energy Thursday morning, about 100 miles south of the Louisiana coast. 13 rig workers had to jump into the Gulf of Mexico to avoid the fire. They were rescued after floating for more than 2 hours. The rig was anchored in 340 feet of water, relatively shallow compared to the BP Deepwater Horizon, which exploded in April, setting off the worst oil spill in U.S. history. Coast Guard and company officials said there is no evidence of leaks, but there were reports yesterday that an oil sheen could be seen near the site. This is White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs.
I'm told this is a production platform about 100 miles off the coast. I'm told the depth of water is about 340 feet, so this is not a deep water facility. As I understand it, the well was not in active production. I will, in some ways, reiterate what I think the Coast Guard has said in a statement that they've released, and that is that they responded to the preliminary reports of a fire on board an oil platform in the Gulf. The initial report that we got were that 13 people were on the platform. They are accounted for. One is injured and is on his way out of that area.
In other oil drilling news, the New York Times is reporting today that BP has warned Congress that if lawmakers pass legislation that bars the company from getting new offshore drilling permits, it may not have the money to pay for all the damages caused by its oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The company says a ban would also imperil the ambitious Gulf Coast restoration efforts that officials want BP to voluntarily support. To talk more about this, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Tyson Slocum, director of Public Citizens Energy Program. Last month, he wrote to the White House expressing concern about allowing BP to use revenue from its existing 149 Gulf of Mexico oil and gas wells as collateral for the $20 billion oil spill victim compensation fund. Tyson Slocum, welcome to Democracy Now!
Great to be here, Juan.
Your reaction to this latest news of another accident on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, first, I'm relieved to hear that no workers died in this catastrophe. But it really underscores that even with all eyes focused on the safety of offshore oil extraction and production, that this accident still occurred. And thankfully, it occurred in shallow water. And if there is an oil leak, it should be relatively easy to plug it, as opposed to the deep water accident with BP, where getting down a mile under the water proved to be extremely difficult. But that said, it underscores the rationale for the continued moratorium on deep water drilling that the Obama administration has enacted through the end of November, because, again, we lack any sort of technology to effectively plug a catastrophic blowout in very deep waters. And so, thankfully, again, this accident was in shallow water. I don't foresee that this is going to have the kind of environmental devastation that the BP accident had. But it really underscores that the offshore oil and gas industry isn't ready yet to deal with offshore drilling, and that we need heightened regulations, and we need the Senate to follow the House legislation that was passed July 30th to strengthen regulations over the entire offshore drilling industry.
Now, Mariner Energy is not well known compared to the giant BP. Do you know anything about its safety record in the past or its role in drilling generally in the Gulf?
Yeah, its safety record doesn't appear to be out of line with many of its competitors. Just an interesting fact about Mariner Energy, it was a unit of Enron until 2004, when two private equity firms purchased it for $271 million. They then took it public, but the top three executives at Mariner Energy were all top executives at Enron during the California electricity crisis of 2000 and 2001. And a couple months ago, a large independent oil and gas operator named Apache Corporation offered to buy Mariner for over $2 billion, and that deal is still in the process of being closed.
Now, we also have this report coming out in the New York Times today now that BP is warning Congress that it may have some problems paying for this victims' compensation fund if it's not allowed to get permits and to continue its drilling and exploration of the Gulf. Could you now? You've raised questions about this in the past about how it used its operations in the Gulf as collateral for this victims' compensation fund. Your reaction to this new report?
Yeah, we've written about this extensively on our website at citizen.org. Remember that President Obama got a voluntary agreement with BP to set up this $20 billion escrow fund to compensate victims of the accident. And everyone thought that was a great idea. We were encouraged by it until we actually got a copy of the contract. Public Citizen was the first organization to actually see a copy of the contract between the Obama administration and BP. We reviewed it, our legal analysts reviewed it, and it's on our website. And this is a deeply flawed contract because, for the first thing, is that the agreement between the Obama administration and BP is not with the parent company, BP. Remember, BP is a gigantic multinational corporation with its headquarters based in London. They've got about $250 billion worth of assets all over the world. But the Obama administration chose to enter into the escrow agreement with a distant remote subsidiary called BP Exploration and Production Incorporated that only has assets and revenues from offshore oil and gas drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. And in our letter to the president earlier this summer, we raised concerns that by linking the financing of the $20 billion victims fund directly with offshore oil and gas production, it compromises the government's continued criminal probes of the company's possible criminal negligence in its offshore oil drilling, but it also ensures that BP is going to have to remain a robust presence in offshore drilling. A far more advantageous approach that the administration should have taken was to have linked the escrow fund to the entire corporation's assets. Therefore, the government would have had access to a diverse array of assets, not all concentrated in the Gulf of Mexico. So this is a deeply flawed contract, and now it offers BP the opportunity to threaten lawmakers with backing off of tougher regulations, threatening lawmakers to not bar BP from getting future leases in the Gulf of Mexico, because BP is dangling this threat that, well, if you deny us the opportunity to continue offshore drilling despite our terrible track record, we're not going to have the money to finance this escrow fund. So the Obama administration did not engage in effective negotiation tactics with BP. BP really has the upper hand here, which is an outrage considering the potential crimes that BP committed. 11 people died, 6 million barrels of oil were dumped into the Gulf of Mexico. And we've got tens of thousands of people that may never financially recover from this harm.
So, in essence, this new report confirms your concerns expressed earlier. Now, also, as I understand it, the BP's of its total worldwide production, only about 10% of it comes from the Gulf. So, in essence, it has segregated its liability in terms of this compensation fund just for that oil revenue coming from the Gulf of Mexico.
Exactly. And this is what we were afraid of. We see corporations do this all the time, where they have sprawling operations, thousands of subsidiaries. And whenever one component of the company has a problem, they isolate that entity legally from the rest of the corporation. And that's exactly what BP has done here. They had a huge liability with the Gulf disaster, and BP entered into a voluntary agreement with the Obama administration to isolate that liability only in its Gulf of Mexico operations, leaving the rest of this enormously profitable and powerful corporation completely intact. And we're not seeking an end to BP, but we need to make sure that BP lives up to its pledge, that it pays all money that is owed, and that it makes everything right for the harm that it created in the Gulf. It is going to take generations and tens of billions, maybe even hundreds of billions of dollars to try and restore the Gulf. And by only entering into an agreement with an isolated subsidiary of BP that only is engaged in offshore drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, we've really put ourselves at a disadvantage. We need to get access to all of BP's assets so that we can have a diverse array of assets to draw upon to pay what is owed the American people.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Tyson Slocum, the director of Public Citizens Energy Program. We have to break, and when we come back, we look at education and how the Obama administration is trying to change the country's schools. Stay with us.
On the oceans and upon high seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are alive. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from sand? Can't you stand?
Mercy, Mercy Me by Marvin Gaye. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Well, it's back to school. And as millions of children around the country begin a new school year, the Obama administration is aggressively moving forward on a number of its education initiatives. On Thursday, federal education officials announced that 44 states have joined a new $330 million initiative to replace year-end English and math tests with new national exams. The funds are drawn from the Obama administration's $4.35 billion Race to the Top fund. The new testing systems are scheduled to be rolled out in the 2014-15 school year. The tests are part of an effort to create a new set of national academic standards known as Common Core Standards, which nearly 40 states have already agreed to adopt. Critics have suggested that national standards would erode state and local control of schools. Meanwhile, through a Race to the Top, Education Secretary Arne Duncan has also pushed states to lift caps on charter schools and link student achievement to teacher pay. The initiative has come under fire from civil rights organizations, community groups, and teachers' unions. Before being appointed Education Secretary, Arne Duncan was the head of Chicago's public schools, the nation's third-largest school system. During that time, he oversaw implementation of a program known as Renaissance 2010. The program's aim was to close 60 schools and replace them with more than 100 charter schools. This year, the Chicago public school system is facing a $370 million deficit. Hundreds of teachers and city school workers are facing layoffs as part of cost-cutting measures and budget cuts. Well, for more on the Obama administration's education initiatives, we're joined by two guests. Lois Wiener is a professor of education at New Jersey City University, and Karen Lewis is the president of the Chicago Teachers Union. I welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
I'd like to start with Karen. Arne Duncan comes from your city.
Yes, sorry.
And he is now basically heading up education policy for the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. Your sense of his legacy in the Chicago public schools?
Well, Arne's legacy was—you know, let's look at the fact that he's not an educator— never had any experience. As a matter of fact, he would be arrested if he went into a classroom and tried to teach, because he's uncredentialed completely. So his legacy is, I don't know what to do. Let me just give it over to the privatizers. Let somebody else do. I mean, basically, under his aegis, the Board of Education abrogated their responsibility towards education and gave it away, because he literally had no idea and still doesn't have an idea of what to do. The problem is, the system is obviously broken. I don't think anybody will argue with that. That the system is broken. It has not basically changed since the 1900s, 1800s for that matter. And as a result, it has never been able to absorb real innovation. And the problem is, it's just a lot easier to test children. Our curriculum has narrowed in Chicago. If you look at the average day for an elementary school kid, it's reading, math. Reading, math. I mean, kids are bored to tears. They're hating school at an early age. There's no joy. There's no passion. And the results show that. They're very indicative of that.
But now, what's wrong with the supporters of Arne Duncan, superintendents like Michelle Rhee in Washington, D.C., Joel Klein in New York City, and some others around the country are saying, what's wrong with having higher accountability standards for teachers? What's wrong with encouraging experimentation and entrepreneurship in terms of how you deliver public education to the millions of children who so far have not been served by the public education system? So what's wrong with that?
Well, the problem is that the whole idea of the business model doesn't work in education. In the business model, you can select how you want to do something. You have an opportunity to innovate in a way that discriminates. It's very easy to do. Whereas in a public school system where we do not select our children, we take whoever comes to the door. What we need is actually more resources and more support for the people that are there and the work that's being done. However, again, Arne Duncan, Michelle Rhee, Joel Klein, I don't know about Joel Klein. None of these people are superintendents. You have to have, again, credentials for that. These are business folks. Look, the business model took this country to the brink of Armageddon in 2008. And yet, we want to follow a failed business model and imprint that on top of public education? No. And these things are not innovative. What they are is they're terrorism, they're my way or the highway, and they're still not producing quote-unquote results. Nobody disagrees with accountability. That's not the issue. The issue is, what do you use? We still know that high-stakes testing basically tell us more about a student's socioeconomic status than it does anything else. And until we're honest about that and want to deal with the fact that we have neighborhoods in our cities and across the nation that have been under-resourced, have been devalued for decades. And for some reason or other, the schools are supposed to fix all that and change that.
Lowell Sweeter, you've been, in your research, conducting what I would, I guess, call a macro analysis of the education reform, comparing not only what's happening here in the United States, but around the world in terms of these so-called reform initiatives. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. And I think it's important to understand that race to the top is not unique to the United States, and what Arne Duncan did in Chicago is not unique to Chicago. And in fact, the contours of this program were carried out first under Pinochet in Chile. And this program was implemented by force of military dictatorships and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in Latin America, and the results have been verified by researchers there. They produced increased stratification. So I think what we're seeing right now are the results of that increased stratification stratification, inequality of results. Because if you think about it, No Child Left Behind is almost a decade old. And what are the results? The results are a growing gap between poor achievement of poor minority kids and those kids who come from prosperous families who are who live in affluent suburbs and in those suburban schools. And I think it's also very important to understand that this focus on educational reform is replacing, is a substitute for a jobs policy. Mm-hmm. We need to understand that. Education can democratize the competition for the existing jobs, but it cannot create new jobs. And when most jobs that are being created are by companies like Walmart, education cannot do anything about that. So we need to—we really need to look critically at Race to the Top and understand the way that it fits in to this new economic order of a so-called jobless recovery, and that what's really going on is a vocationalization of education, a watering down of curriculum for most kids, so that they're going to take jobs that require only a seventh or an eighth grade education, because those are the jobs that are being created in this economy. And so I think that while it's important to look at the particulars of each state and each city, each school district, it's also important to see this large picture, because almost anything that you can point to me that's being done in Chicago or New York or San Francisco, we can find another place in the world that it was already done, and we can look at those results, and the results are not good.
But those who are at the forefront of this so-called reform movement say that the charter schools that they're creating, the small schools that they're creating, are doing a better job by the testing model of educating children, especially minority children, than has occurred in decades past under the existing public school system. What's your response to that?
My response to that, first of all, is that I want to see the evidence. And what's really incredible and disastrous is that this enormous social engineering that's going on to transform, I would say destroy, public education has not been accompanied by government funding for serious objective evaluation. We have this so-called Institute for Education Science, but if you look at the sorts of research that they're funding, they are not funding the kind of large-scale evaluative studies that we need to determine whether these reforms are going to be effective. And we shouldn't permit that. We should identify this as what it is, which is an ideological venture that does not have a scientific basis, and it doesn't have a basis in evidence.
You've also taken a look at the impact of No Child Left Behind on teachers. Could you talk about that?
Well, I think it's important to understand that there are No Child Left Behind is part of this global project to deprofessionalize teaching as an occupation. And the reason that it's important in this project to deprofessionalize teaching is that the thinking is that the biggest expenditure in education is teacher salaries. And they want to cut costs. They want to diminish the amount of money that's put into public education. And that means they have to lower teacher costs. And in order to do that, they have to deprofessionalize teaching. They have to make it a revolving door, in which we're not going to pay teachers very much. They're not going to stay very long. We're going to credential them really fast. They're going to go in. We're going to burn them up. They're going to leave in 3, 4, 5 years. And that's the model that they want. So who is the biggest impediment to that occurring? Teachers' unions. And that is what explains this massive propaganda effort to say that teachers' unions are an impediment to reform. And in fact, they are an impediment to the deprofessionalization of teaching, which I think is a disaster. It's a disaster for public education.
Well, you know, I've been for several years now looking deeply into these charter schools and especially their tax forms. And one of the things that has struck me as I look at their various audited financial statements is that, generally speaking, the pay levels of the teachers in the charter schools are far lower than they are for normal public school teachers. But the pay of the executives of the charter schools is far higher than it is for superintendents. So you're, in essence, creating a much bigger wage gap in the schools through the charters between management and the employees who actually cover the work. I'm wondering what you found.
Part of the, you know, that's part of the thinking here, that you teaching really is not does not have to be a skilled profession, because we're not going to teach, we're not going to educate kids to do anything more than work in Walmart or the equivalent. They only need a seventh or an eighth grade education, at most a ninth grade education. And so we don't need teachers who are more than, as Grover Whitehurst, a former undersecretary of education, said, good enough. That's all we need is teachers who are good enough to follow scripted curriculum and to teach to these standardized tests. And if you only need teachers who are good enough, you don't have to pay them very much. And that's the project. And it, regardless of the rhetoric, regardless of the intentions of some of the people who are supporting these reforms, people like the Education Trust, whose work I respect, I think it's important that we look at something beyond the intentions and the rhetoric, and we really look at this project as being a project that's global in its nature.
Well, Karen, you led an basically an insurgent movement within your own union to win the presidency of the UFT, of the Chicago Federation of Teachers.
No, Chicago Teachers Union.
Teachers Union, I'm sorry.
Yes, that's okay.
And could you talk about how you did that and the relationship of the teachers with the community in general in terms of dealing with these education reforms?
Well, the Caucus of Rank-and-File Educators, a CORE, spent 2 years basically organizing with parents and community groups against school closings, against the turnarounds, and against the Duncan policies. We did not have an electoral strategy, to be perfectly honest with you. We just wanted to see a change in this whole idea of privatizing schools. And what we found was that, in general, there's this animosity between teachers and parents and communities because we haven't been working together. And yet we are still seeing the same the devastation of our communities based on the fact that our institutions have been underfunded. So what we ended up doing was spending a lot of time talking to our members across the city. And the more we got ready to speak, and in addition to the fact, we changed the way the Board of Education does business. They would put schools on a hit list, and they were closed down, and that was it. We forced the board to start coming to these community meetings. They had never shown up. They just basically rubber-stamped whatever Arne Duncan wanted. And, of course, when Arne Duncan left, the guy that came in, equally as unqualified, had a slightly different vision. So six schools were taken off the hit list. That had never happened. But in addition, our union leadership was nowhere to be found during these hearings. We went to every school closing hearing, every charter school opening. And in addition, we had data that showed that these charter schools not only did no better, but that in some cases actually did worse than the neighborhood schools. And the problem is that those studies never get publicized, and certainly not in mainstream corporate media. So we had an uphill battle because nobody would talk to us, nobody paid any attention to us. But school by school, building by building, that's how you build consensus. That's how you build capacity for change.
You are a veteran chemistry teacher.
I am.
Could you talk about the impact of these so-called reforms on your own ability to teach chemistry?
You know, I'm going to be honest with you. Being a veteran teacher, I have basically ignored them, to be real honest. But I've had that ability because of the fact that I am so passionate about teaching and that I care about what I do and that the results I get, which are not test-driven as far as I'm concerned, are what speak for themselves. I mean, ultimately, administrators want to know how well you relate to your students, how well you relate to parents. And I've always had that ability to do that. So as far as I'm concerned, these so-called reforms just get out of my way, as far as I was concerned.
And Lois Weiner, can you compare what's happened in Chicago with the teachers there to some of the bigger unions, to the United Federation of Teachers, to what's been happening with the NEA in terms of confronting some of these changes?
You know, I think that CORE's victory is really a watershed, and I'm just delighted. And I have to say that I spoke at a rally of CORE earlier this year, and I heard Karen speak to teachers in the audience. And what struck me in the way that Karen talked about the reforms and what's going on in public education was her passion about teaching. And I think it's the fact that CORE contains teachers who are committed to social justice. They're committed to a new form of teacher unionism. And they're committed to facing racism. It really makes it a model for what we want to do in unions elsewhere. I have to say, especially the UFT here in New York. But we're beginning to see in other large city locals a renaissance of activism among young teachers, because unlike Karen, they're not protected. Mm-hmm. And these reforms, they're losing their jobs, they're being terrorized by principals, their schools are being shut down, because very often they teach in the most vulnerable schools, because they're new and that's where the jobs are. And they want a union. They want a union that's going to fight for them. And the message that we have to bring them is, I think, that CORE does, is you are the union. Nobody can do it for you. And I think in New York City, we're beginning to see that. I've been working with this group called Teachers Unite. And I think it's a ginger group for the kind of reform that we need in New York City. Los Angeles already has a reform leadership. Detroit has a reform leadership in the AFT. And I think that that's going to pull, those changes are going to pull, I'm hopeful, the national unions to more progressive, more militant, and more pro-parent and pro-education stances.
Let me ask you also about the intervention of other elite forces on this education reform debate. The right-wing foundations, the Walton Foundation, the Eli Broad Foundation, as well as all of the hedge fund and Wall Street people that have gotten involved in funding schools and creating charter networks. What do you analyze as behind this?
Well, I mean, their effect has been really all-encompassing and quite pernicious. And we have a great deal of research about what's going on with this if we want to take a look at it. It's never mentioned in the popular media, in the corporate mass media. They are controlling the education agenda. They are controlling these new CORE curriculum standards. And if people really looked at these CORE curriculum standards, I think they would be aghast. You know, vocationalization of the curriculum is beginning in first grade. They're doing career education in first grade, if you look at these standards. What is that about? That we're preparing kids for the workforce when they're in first grade, and the foundations, the right-wing foundations, including the Gates Foundation, they are absolutely driving this. They're funding it. They're funding the media campaign to persuade people that this is necessary. And they're funding the
research.
They're funding the research.
They're funding the research. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Karen Lewis was president of the Chicago Teachers Union. Lois Weiner, professor of education at New Jersey City University. And we will continue to follow this story. We're going to take a break now. And when we return, CEO pay and how it's linked to layoffs.
You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Well, my goodness gracious, let me tell you the news. My head's been wet with the midnight dew. I've been down on bended knee, talking to the man from Galilee. He spoke to me with a voice so sweet, I thought I heard the shuffle of angels feet. He called my name and my heart stood still when he said, John, go do my will. Go tell that long-tongued liar.
God Gonna Cut You Down, sung by Johnny Cash. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Juan Gonzalez. 2 years ago, 2 years into the recession, there's one small group of Americans who are not feeling the bite of the economic downturn. CEOs. Chief executive pay in 2009 more than doubled the CEO pay average for the decades of the 1990s. It more than quadrupled the CEO pay average for the 1980s and ran approximately 8 times the CEO average for all the decades of the mid-20th century. And a new study from the Institute of Policy Studies shows that CEOs who fired the most workers during the recession took home the highest pay. According to that study, the CEOs of the 50 corporations responsible for the biggest layoffs were paid an average of $12 million. 42% more than the average pay for the Standard & Poor's 500. The study covered the period from November 2008 to April of this year. For 72% of companies, mass layoffs were announced during periods of profit and high CEO salaries. For more on this story, I'm joined now from Washington, D.C. by the lead author of the report titled Executive Excess, 2010, CEO Pay and the Great Recession. Sarah Anderson is Global Economy Project Director at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Great to be here, Juan. Thanks.
Well, Sarah, lay out what you found.
Yeah. Well, we thought, obviously, since we're in the middle of such a terrible jobs crisis, that it would be a good idea to look at the companies that have cut the most jobs under this crisis and then look at how the CEOs at those companies were doing. And I guess it wasn't any surprise to us to find that the CEOs of these top job-cutting companies weren't really tightening their own belts. But what was truly outrageous was to find out that they were actually making significantly more than their overpaid peers at other big U.S. companies. And so, to be specific, what we looked at were the 50 companies that have had the most layoffs. All of them have cut more than 3,000 jobs since November 2008. And as you said, on average, they made $12 million last year, which was 42% more than S&P 500 CEOs as a whole.
What are some of those companies? And name the executives and their pay.
Yeah. Well, one that's very interesting, I think, is Mark Hurd at Hewlett-Packard, because he's been all over the headlines lately because he got fired a couple of weeks ago. He was fired because he tried to conceal a relationship with a female contractor who also happened to be a former erotic film star and a reality TV star. And, you know, I find stories like this as titillating as the next person. But I was amazed to see that these stories all ignored the fact that this is a guy who has laid off more than 30,000 workers at Hewlett-Packard over the last few years while earning more than $20 million a year. Now, to me, that is the real scandal at Hewlett-Packard. But we're not hearing much about these kinds of stories. There's still the impression, I think, the misconception that when CEOs make these big mass layoffs, that they're being the good, tough guys. They're making the tough decisions necessary to make their companies mean and lean. And yes, that might boost their profits in the short term by cutting all of those costs. But we want to point out that these kinds of layoffs can have very serious long-term costs for the companies, not just for the workers themselves. That's obvious. But there's a lot of costs associated with these kinds of mass layoffs in terms of lower worker morale, in terms of costs associated with having to train and rehire workers down the road. And so we see it as just another example of the kind of short-termism, the short-term thinking of business leaders that got us into this crisis in the first place.
Can you tell us of some other companies? Wasn't General Motors one of the ones that laid off the most workers in the past year?
Yeah. General Motors, the CEO there didn't have the highest pay, but it was substantial, I think around $15 million or so. Everybody's hoping that GM will turn things around and get people working again. And we think that in a severe crisis like GM has gone through, it really would have been the best thing for the CEO of the company to also really tighten his belt. I mean, I'm not going to deny that job cuts are necessary sometimes in situations where it might mean that the survival of a company, you have to make cuts in some certain situations. But then the CEOs themselves should also have to tighten their belts. And we should be looking to lift up examples of CEOs who use creative ways to avoid layoffs, to maintain jobs. There are ways you can work with your workforces to work these things out. And we're not seeing recognition going to those kinds of CEOs. We're seeing the recognition going to the ones that are making the big job cuts.
And are there any in particular that you think should be noted for keeping their salaries down and keeping layoffs down?
I'm not really aware of examples. We don't really hear much about them in the media, at least not recently. You can look for some ideas at European countries where they have policies that discourage layoffs by requiring higher severance payments and other things to really promote preserving jobs. They also have a system called, in German it's called Kurzarbeit, but it's where the government can help pay for part of a worker's salary with reduced hours, just to be able to keep them on payroll through tough times. And I think there are some experiments with that in some of the U.S. states as well. Overall, the European countries have tried to avoid the kind of real devastating effects that we've seen in the U.S. And, of course, have stronger social protection and unemployment insurance programs there as well. So we can learn from other countries. And in Europe also, in about a dozen countries, they require big companies to have representatives of workers on their boards. We think that could really help with the executive pay problems as well.
Okay. Well, Sarah Anderson, we'll have to leave it there. The Global Economy Project Director at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's the lead author of the new Executive Excess Report. It's been a month since torrential rains triggered the worst floods in Pakistan's recent history. Nearly 20 million people are homeless or hungry, with 1 million people displaced in the past week alone. The official death toll is at 1,760, but is expected to rise as survivors are threatened by diseases. Thousands remain trapped by floodwaters in the hardest-hit southern province of Sindh, while there are reports of others going without food or water for days. In southern Pakistan, hundreds of hungry families from a relief camp in the city of Thatta blocked the highway for 3 hours Wednesday, demanding the government provide more food and shelter. The United Nations says relief and humanitarian efforts need to take place on an unprecedented scale, given the vast number of people affected. Well, freelance journalist Medea Tahir filed this report for Democracy Now! From the Razakabad relief camp in Karachi, Pakistan.
This is a common sight at this refugee camp on the outskirts of Pakistan's teeming port city, Karachi. Almost 8,000 people live at this camp alone, all displaced by the heavy flooding that has put a quarter of Pakistan underwater. Many of them fled their villages and homes with little more than the clothes they were wearing. When private donors drive through this camp dispatching clothes, money, or food, refugees mob their cars. Sometimes the competition can turn violent.
There was a van that came here 3 or 4 days ago into the camp. They smashed its windows.
Razakabad camp is one of 28 camps that have been set up around Karachi to handle the tide of incoming refugees. By rough estimates, there are already 4.5 million internally displaced people, or IDPs, from the flooding in Pakistan. Many of the refugees are complaining of government mismanagement. Abdul Ghani has been at this camp for 12 days with his wife and children. He shows me what he received to wear from the camp organizers. It's a short skirt.
I got these from the camp administrators, from the people in charge. They keep all the good stuff, while this is my fate.
His neighbor, across from him, has been more lucky. His name is Gul Hassan.
Private donors directly give us blankets and even new clothes. The camp administrators are keeping all the stuff they've been given to distribute. All we are saying is that those things are for us. We should get them.
Complaints of inefficiency and corruption are not limited to the IDPs. International donors have also been reluctant to donate to the Pakistani government for the same reason. Adding to that image is the federal government itself. It's been repeatedly caught setting up fake medical and relief camps for photo ops. But the situation on the ground with the local government, which is most directly addressing the IDP crisis, is more complicated. Sayyida Sheila Raza, who is an elected local official and deputy speaker of the Sindh Provincial Assembly, explains.
This is a natural disaster. It exceeded all our expectations, so we won't be able to provide relief to everyone.
I met Minister Raza at her home in Karachi, where volunteers were busy working in her living room, organizing donations brought by private donors. All the clothes and many other items for the IDPs are provided by private donors. A wealthy financier has taken charge of the meals at the Razakabad camp. The government appears to have limited itself to providing tents, water tankers, and health facilities. But Minister Raza says her team has been working hard to register the IDPs, organize medical teams, and even to start a school. She dismisses charges of corruption and says the media is exaggerating the government's inefficiency.
Yes, we must be making some mistakes along the way. We could improve our system, but our intentions are good. Yes, it looks good on camera when the media comes and throws donation packages at IDPs and that creates chaos and looting and someone gets injured, and then the media gets to say, look at the conditions in the camps. I'm sure it does wonders for the media's ratings.
In fact, a television channel was shooting when I went to the camp. They were filming camp residents running to grab food packages that the production team itself was throwing at them. Dr. Sayyid Jafar Ahmed is director of the Pakistan Study Center at Karachi University. He says that the Pakistani state hasn't entirely collapsed, but he also says it doesn't have the capacity to deal with the floods because it has been weakened by decades of bad policies, including those coming from Washington.
Pakistan's democracy has been weakened due to two or three major reasons, and I would say that the role of United States is one major factor. Because of the four military rules in Pakistan, three were directly influenced by United States. The overall military rule in Pakistan accounts for some 33 years out of 63 years of Pakistan's history. And these military rules were encouraged and backed by the United States, and with the result that we did not have political process in this country.
The U.S. has agreed to $200 million of flood aid relief to help the 20 million Pakistanis affected by the floods. By comparison, it will spend close to $2 billion this year in military aid on Pakistan. That's over $150 million per month.
It is in the forefront of the donors so far. And on the other hand, in the North Waziristan and South Waziristan, we hear about drone attacks.
Even as Pakistan struggled to cope with the floods, U.S. drones killed 13 people on August 14th, Pakistan's Independence Day. Such priorities have led Washington to prefer dealing with unelected actors like Pakistan's army, leaving the elected civilian government to play second fiddle. With the devastation of the floods, Dr. Jaffer says, it's now more important than ever that Washington work with Pakistan's government in providing flood relief.
I think that for a country like United States, do you want to strengthen democracy in Pakistan or not? Our flood specific act can be very helpful, that we are going to give this much to Pakistan for its reconstruction and rehabilitation of the people, provided certain conditions are met.
With or without Washington, Pakistan's government has a lengthy task ahead.
Madia Tahir, reporting from Pakistan for Democracy Now! That does it for today's show. Tune in Monday for our Labor Day special with Michael Moore. Amy Goodman will be back on Tuesday. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.